Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, James Hansen, wrote a recent piece in The Guardian and asks this question: will our short attention span be the end of us? Just a month after the second storm of a century in 2 years, the media moves on to the latest scandal with barely a retrospective glance at the implications of the extreme climate anomalies that we have seen. Hurricane Sandy was not just a storm. It was a stark illustration of the power that climate change can deliver today to our doorsteps. Our guest, James Hansen, is speaking today. He's the keynote speaker, actually, at the 10th Annual Sustainability Summit and Exposition, which has been taking place all week in Milwaukee. And he is one of the country's premier climate scientists. He is director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and adjunct professor at Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Studies. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him on this topic. We will have many. I would suggest you call in as soon as you know you want to call in. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. James Hansen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's do a retrospective of your warnings. You have been studying this issue, talking about this issue, trying to direct public attention to this issue since the 1980s, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. And we're running out of time for the public to understand it.
What did you say then?
What I said then was it's time to stop waffling so much and recognize that the greenhouse gases are beginning to affect our climate. Now we finally reached a point where the public should be able to see that. We could see it then only in the average. When you looked at the global average temperature, we could see that the increase over a period of decades was large enough that it was not natural variability. But on a local basis, the weather is so variable that it's much more difficult for the public to recognize that something is happening. But now we finally reached a point where they should recognize that the anomalies that we're seeing are not normal. And unfortunately, the climate system, you know, it has inertia. It doesn't respond quickly to the changes in the atmospheric composition that we're making. So we've only felt half of the effect of the gases that are already in the atmosphere, and we're adding more every year. So that's what makes it a very dangerous problem because of this time lag.
I want to ask you to get just a little closer to your phone. Your level is just a little bit low here. So thank you. I would appreciate that. And you talk about Hurricane Sandy in this piece in The Guardian. You say that it really was, and we didn't even hear much analysis of this, that it was an illustration that climate change is at our doorsteps. This storm was the result of climate change?
Well, hurricanes are natural. They occur all the time. In this particular one, Sandy, it came up the east coast, and the water there was unusually warm, the hurricane was unusually late in the hurricane season because the planet is getting warmer, and the ocean was warmer, which allowed it to remain a Category 1 hurricane all the way up to New York City. And then it combined with a frontal storm and moved inland, so it was particularly damaging. And the damage was greater because sea level is beginning to rise several inches already, so that the waves coming in were higher than they would have been without that. So it's more an example of, and the warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, which is the fuel for storms, for thunderstorms, for tornadoes, for tropical storms like Hurricane Sandy. So if you have a warmer atmosphere, more water vapor, you can have more powerful storms. So it is, to some degree, an example of what we're going to get more of in the future.
And it's not just storms. You also talk about increased heat speeding up evaporation, causing more extreme droughts, and we experienced some of that in the Midwest last year.
Yes, in fact, that's what I testified about in 1988 and 1989, that warming causes more extreme climate changes at both ends of the hydrologic cycle. At the times and places when it's dry, the higher temperatures cause more extreme evaporation and more extreme droughts and greater heat waves. But the weather fluctuates, and at other times, because the atmosphere is warmer, you get more evaporation from the ocean, and therefore you get heavier rainfalls and more frequent extreme floods. So the 100-year flood is going to occur more often than once every 100 years. And the droughts are going to be more extreme. They're accompanied by wildfires, which burn hotter and are more damaging. So there are effects that the public should begin to notice.
I think that some of the public is extremely frightened by all of this. You have been urging us to look at the scientific evidence on climate change for 25 years. It's not just yesterday. Why haven't we paid attention to this and done something? Why are we suffering?
Well, it's because the source of the problem is the carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels.
Yes.
And those fossil fuels have been very useful to us because they've, you know, powered our economy. Unfortunately, what we've realized is we're going to have to move to cleaner energies, or we're going to leave a situation for young people that's out of their control. We're going to need to find energies that do not produce these gases and move to energy efficiency and clean energies.
So you have looked at, you've compared a tax on this to other methods of lessening our dependence on fossil fuels. What is the best way to lessen our dependence? What kind of tax do we need? Is it a tax?
Yeah, it's not rocket science. It's really pretty simple. The reason that we keep using fossil fuels is that they are the cheapest energy.
Mm-hmm.
They appear to be the cheapest energy, but that's partly because they're subsidized and mainly because they do not pay their cost to society. So the air pollution and water pollution, which causes a lot of health problems, about 40,000 deaths per year in the United States and about 1 million worldwide. When you get asthma or any health problem because of pollution, you have to pay that yourself. It's not paid by the fossil fuel companies. And now these climate impacts, when we get climate disasters, the public is picking up the problem, either paying directly through the damage or the government will provide relief, which now comes on with bills of tens of billions of dollars. So what we need to do is put an honest price on fossil fuels. We should collect a fee from the fossil fuel companies at the domestic mine or the port of entry, and we should distribute that money. Don't give it to the government for bigger governments, but distribute 100% of it to the public on a per capita basis. So the person who does better than average in limiting his fossil fuel use will actually get more in his monthly dividend than he pays in increased prices. And in that way, it would spur innovations and it would encourage people to make changes in their lifestyle and in their choices when they buy a vehicle and various things. And we could move quite rapidly to a cleaner energy. Economic modeling has shown that if we put $10 a ton fee on carbon, increase that $10 each year so that after 10 years it's $100, that would increase the price of fuels, but 60% of the people would get more in their dividend than they pay in increased prices. And it would spur movements toward efficiency and clean energies that would reduce our carbon footprint 30%. That's 11 times greater than the amount of oil that the Keystone XL pipeline would carry. So it's a much more sensible approach than trying to go after more and more dirtier and dirtier fossil fuels.
And what clean energies are ready to go, and what are the best clean energies?
Well, that depends, and it depends on where you are, and it depends on your preference. My opinion is that to get the baseload electric power that we need, we should be doing the research and development on advanced generation nuclear power. But that depends. You know, you don't let the alternatives compete. There are different clean energies. There's energy efficiency. In countries like China and India, I think they're going to need to move to nuclear power in order to get off of coal, because they've become the biggest emitters. And they recognize that, and China is building 30 nuclear power plants right now. Mm. So it depends on where you are, but there are a number of different clean energies.
You can't even breathe in China. Those stories every now and then, people just can't go outside. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to bring a huge number of people out of poverty. So they're burning coal to beat the band, but they don't intend to do that on the long run. And they're seeing the consequences and the local pollution. So they've got to move quickly to cleaner energy.
We're going to welcome phone calls for James Hansen, and we'll do that in just one moment. The Midwest Sustainability Summit is taking place in Milwaukee this week, and James Hansen is the keynote speaker today. He has been studying climate change, warning the world about climate change for a long time, for at least the past 25 years. He's director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, adjunct professor in Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Studies. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. There is one line open for you if you would like to join this important conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. James Hansen, our guest this hour, he is going to be giving the keynote speech on Global Sustainability 2, Challenge of the Century, today at the Sustainability Conference Summit that is taking place in Milwaukee. We have a number of phone calls. We start with Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, yes, this is an honor and good for Wisconsin Public Radio for getting Dr. Hansen on the air. I just saw an absolutely unbelievable, or fascinating rather, TED Talk yesterday by Alan Savory, who's a biologist and talks about combating carbon in the atmosphere through rangeland management. He talks about desertification, why much of the world is becoming desert, and offers some techniques they have used on a not on a tiny basis, but on a way to deal with that. I'm just wondering whether Dr. Hansen knows of it and feels that there is enough there to perhaps tip some balance someday, and I'll listen off the air.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, you know, it's clear we've already burned 370 gigatons of carbon, put that into the atmosphere. And because of the infrastructure that we have, even if governments finally begin to recognize we have to phase over to clean energies, there's going to be a lot more that gets up there. And if we leave it all up there, we are going to cause problems for the next generation, which means that we're going to have to get some of it out of there. And it's reasonably clear that we can probably get of the order of 100 gigatons out of the atmosphere if we use improved forestry and agricultural practices, there are ways to store more carbon in the soil and in the biosphere. If we reforest marginal lands that are not useful for agriculture, we can store quite a lot of carbon. But also, we can store a lot more carbon in the soil. So those things will be very helpful, but they can only take up so much. So that's why we've got to get onto clean energy sooner. But once we realize that, you know, we've passed the dangerous point, we're going to have to suck something out of the atmosphere, then the best way to do that will be with semi-natural approaches in which we just use better practices which allow more to be stored in the soil.
Can you comment just a little more on nuclear when you talk about advanced nuclear plants? This has been, as you obviously know, an area of some concern about waste from nuclear plants, about the stability of plants. Some people
that's a very important matter. You know, the nuclear plants that exist now are 50-year-old technology, light water reactors that burn about 1% of the fuel in the nuclear fuel, of the energy in the nuclear fuel. The other 99% is left in a waste pile, which has a half-life of more than 10,000 years, and it creates a tremendous headache because nobody wants it in their backyard. You have to babysit it forever. The scientist who first started with nuclear power had no intention that would be the form of nuclear power that would be used for peaceful purposes. There are ways, so-called fast reactors, that let the neutrons move faster, which can burn more than 99% of the energy and leave a waste pile that has a half-life measured in decades instead of millennia. So that there's a lot of potential. And also, you can now have reactors that do not require an energy source to cool. They can use convective cooling so that if there's any anomaly, an earthquake or other accident, you could just shut down automatically the plant and let it keep itself cool without the necessity of having a separate power source. So there are much more capable nuclear possibilities, but because of the fear that has been developed in many people's minds, we're just not developing them here. And it's become so expensive to build a nuclear plant in the United States because of the way the permitting process works that I don't have too much hope for the U.S. leading the way in this, but I think we should help those countries that want to replace their coal with nuclear. That means India and China, because we have much better technology, and we're all on the same planet. We're all going to suffer from climate change if we don't slow down these emissions.
Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Let's go to Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting program. I do believe that we probably could do a lot more with hydrogen power, natural gas, and so forth. I guess one of my problems with your guest's proposition is, in theory, it sounds really plausible, but I'm very skeptical of adding taxes and fees to things like fossil fuel, because in the long run, the consumer is the one that bites the bullet on it. And there's no way of regulating it. Until we can regulate countries like China and South American countries, it ends up being the United States carrying the brunt. And, you know, if we can't do better than a battery-powered car that really is completely inefficient, then I don't see anything other than fossil fuel at this point being a viable alternative to what we have. So we have to get cars and things that run on something other than fossil fuels. And until that happens, I'm not in favor of adding taxes to what we already have.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. But in order to provide the incentive for these alternatives, We need to have an honest price on carbon. You know, your question started with regard to how would we make this work for China and other countries. The good thing about having a flat, honest fee across the board is that we can put border duties on products from countries that do not have an equivalent carbon price, and that would provide an enormous incentive for them to have an equivalent carbon fee, because then they could collect the money themselves rather than have us collect it at our border. So, you know, until we make fossil fuels pay their honest price, people are just going to keep burning those because they appear to be the cheapest fuel. But there are certainly alternatives, and we must eventually find those, because fossil fuels would run out eventually, but long before we reach that, we would have dramatic climate change, which I don't want to wish on my children and grandchildren.
What kinds of cars should we be driving?
Well, the easiest thing to do is make them more efficient. That helps. But we are going to need to have propulsion, because individual vehicles are just so attractive to people, not only in the United States, but every country. As soon as they start to get wealthy, they want to have individual vehicles. Mm-hmm. So we have to have a form of moving them that does not pollute the atmosphere. So electric cars are a possibility. There's now, you know, the Tesla with the battery that goes all the way from the front to the back of the car can get 300 miles. Hydrogen was talked about, but then you would need a whole new fuel distribution system. But there are other ways of powering a car. There's actually a book written about a boron-powered car, which... There are various possibilities, but they're not going to happen until we have an honest price on fossil fuels, because otherwise gasoline is just appears to be the cheapest way to do it.
Dr. James Hansen is our guest this hour. He's director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, adjunct professor in Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Studies. He is a climate scientist, extremely well known all over the world, and has been talking about global warming for 25 years. It's here, he says. And it's manifesting itself all over the place, including Hurricane Sandy. So we're talking about manifestations of it and what we do to counter global warming. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Hansen is speaking today at the Energy Summit, the Sustainability Summit that's taking place and has been taking place all week in Milwaukee. Ben in Madison, hi.
Oh, good morning. I want to mention just briefly part of what got us here, which I'm sure followers of this subject will be familiar with. Industry lobbying, kind of capturing the attention of Congress in order that they do nothing or act like climate change is something invented or some sort of liberal conspiracy. And also just apathy on the part of just about everyone I know. I used to think it was maybe more people more conservatively inclined who would not worry about wasting fuel or have a larger house than they need or drive a giant SUV. But I notice everyone does this. All of us in our daily lives, we leave the car running for 20 minutes. We heat our house and leave the heat on while we're gone for 5 hours. We just, all of us, contribute to this problem. But I wanted to ask what you thought the PR strategy side could be. I know you're a scientist and maybe that's not your thing, but if we think about anti-smoking campaigns or other past PR successes where we actually change the public's behavior, I wonder what you think we could do to really basically raise the consciousness of the country and point out what a really big problem this is and get everyone engaged in working together towards a solution.
Yeah, that's the difficult problem. In the case of tobacco, the tobacco companies were successful for quite a few years in holding off changes, and it was partly because of the amount of money they had, and they could control advertisements, and that you'd hear about medical doctors for Camels or whatever. But eventually the public caught on that these advertisements were pretty much misinformation. And once they realized that, then those advertisements no longer worked. When they saw them, they would say baloney. We have to get to that point with the fossil fuel industry because they are controlling the airwaves, and they also control our governments. Our government is well-oiled and coal-fired. And they, Congress people think that if they win an election that they have the right to be wealthy. And the way they achieve that wealth usually is by eventually becoming lobbyists. I give the example of Dick Gephardt. When he failed to get the nomination for president, he just retired. And in the first year, he got $120,000 per quarter from Peabody Coal. That's one source. That is inappropriate. We should not have a government in which legislatures can be bought. And unfortunately, this campaign finance reform just doesn't catch on because it's got to be Congress that changes it. So it's a difficulty. We've got to get to the point that the public understands what's happening. And we had better get there pretty soon because time is running short. We're already beginning to see the climate effects, and there's more in the pipeline, and there's more fossil fuels in the pipeline. So I wish I had a good answer as to how we get the public to realize that they're being bamboozled by the fossil fuel industry. But it's a hard question to answer.
We talked some about a tax. The other solution that we hear frequently about, and that President Obama did back, was the cap-and-trade proposal allowing clean companies to sell their leftover pollution credits to companies that were not very clean. You are not a fan of that, are you?
No. I was recently at a meeting in which Jerry Brown, the governor of California, was in the front row, and I said that their cap-and-trade with offsets program was half-baked and half-assed. And he took that pretty well. I actually had a discussion with him after that meeting, and he agrees that you really prefer a simple, honest system, because if you have offsets, they don't really work. And the cap-and-trade system, that was the Kyoto Protocol approach. It simply is ineffectual. And there's so many eyes and hooks in it. The bill that they tried to pass in the United States Senate had 3,000 pages with giveaways to utilities, to coal companies, to the oil companies. You don't want a complicated system. You want a very simple, honest fee on rises over time, but the money has to go to the public. You don't want Congress giving it away to special interests. And until the public demands such a simple system, I don't think we can solve the problem.
Charles in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi.
Good morning. I wonder whether or not this Canadian oil, tar sands, is all like what they call the sediment from tanks, the bunker sea oils. It has to be heated to pump it, even in the summertime. And how are they going to pump anything like that to Houston, Texas, for Pete's sakes?
Yeah, it does present special problems. It takes about 23%. More energy just to get it out of the ground and to process it, because it's dirty stuff. This tar sands, the same with tar shale. These directions that the fossil fuel companies are turning now is toward these dirtier fuels, which pollute the regional environment where they're mined, but also it takes energy to get them out, and then it takes more energy to refine them and make them into the products that are finally sold. So they really don't make sense. Only if the governments help out the industry by, you know, in effect subsidizing them, allowing them rights to have pipelines, and so they're not in the public's interest. They're in the interest of only a very few people who are making a lot of money off them, and that's what the public needs to understand.
June is next in Milwaukee. Hi, June.
Hi, thank you. Several years ago, I was looking into getting solar panels for my ranch home, and of course, the price was prohibitive. It was something like $45,000.
Whoa!
But at the same time, I was reading that a couple of people in California and a business that was started in a garage had come up with some really inexpensive solar panels that could unroll, that you could easily install on your roof, and they were a fraction of that cost. So I thought, I'll wait for that, because they said in about 2 or 3 years it would be out. And then I heard that Exxon or one of the other large companies had purchased their patent, purchased their product, purchased the right to produce it, and Exxon gave them millions, but then Exxon sat on it, so none of us can get it. They're still selling their fossil fuels. So can you please comment on that?
Well, I think with solar panels and with wind, they are economically competitive now if you take advantage of the incentive programs. In fact, I have on my barn, I have the roof covered with solar panels, and it makes sense for me because the state of Pennsylvania gave me a $17,000 rebate, and the federal government gave me a 30% rebate via reductions in taxes. And so in that case, it will pay off over a period of, it'll take more than a decade now. And also the utilities are forced to buy the electricity that I generate, because I'm generating twice as much as we use. But the difficulty with these intermittent renewable energies is that we don't have a good energy storage. So we haven't really reached the point where they are economically competitive for baseload electric power. And it works. They work only as long as they're a small enough percentage of the total that the rest of the ratepayers can, in effect, subsidize them. But there's still think they have a significant role to play. Their cost has been coming down, but it's not yet quite at the point that they're going to take off in a major way, I'm afraid, without the help of substantial subsidies.
We go to John next in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering a question of your professor, whether or not the CO2 released from wood burning is as dangerous as the CO2 from fossil fuels?
No, the CO2 from fossil fuels will stay in the surface carbon reservoirs. That's the atmosphere, the ocean, and the biosphere and soil for millennia, for tens of thousands of years. And so it's really different than the CO2 you get from burning wood, because other trees can grow in their place. And so that's what we call renewable energy. If we don't replant the trees, then it's temporarily as bad as the fossil fuel CO2. But we do have the potential to improve our forestry and agricultural practices so that carbon that came from burning any biofuels will actually get taken back up by the system. But that's not the case for the fossil fuels. That is why they are a problem.
When are we going to? We were talking about running out of fossil fuels some 50 years ago in this country. Is it imminent or not?
Unfortunately, it's not.
It's not.
If we continue to go after every fossil fuel we can imagine, going to the deepest ocean and going to the Arctic and onto pristine public lands, and using these more and more damaging practices like fracking, then we can get a lot. Unfortunately, we could get enough to make the planet ice-free. The last time we had 1,000 ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere, there was no ice on the planet, and sea level was 250 feet higher. Well, there's enough fossil fuels to do that. So we just can't use them all. That's, unfortunately, our policymakers do not seem to understand that.
Dr. James Hansen, our guest this hour, climate scientist, preeminent climate scientist. He is today the keynote speaker at the 10th Annual Sustainability Summit, which is taking place in Milwaukee. He is director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and adjunct professor in Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Studies. He's a climate scientist who's been studying and alerting the public to issues of global warming for a long, long time. Phone lines, one is open. If you can't get through on the phone, well, you can send an email if you'd like to do that. That's talk@wpr.org. You can also use our Facebook page to leave messages, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for preeminent climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing well. My comment's basically the way they're pulling the wool over most people's eyes is by telling them that it's all about jobs. If we do this, it's going to cost the country jobs. Like, there's an iron mine that's supposed to go in northern Wisconsin. And if you look at, say, northern Minnesota, where the iron mines have been and are, it's just desolate, disgusting, polluted. And, you know, they're saying if this mine does not go into Wisconsin, it's going to cost the Wisconsin state lots of money and lots of jobs. And it's sickening to think that they don't really care so much about the environment as they do making a little piece of paper that, well, comes from the environment if you look at the paper side of it.
Yeah, well, you know, the truth is that the fossil fuel industry does not employ as many people as it used to. In the case of coal mining, the way we do it now is often just have bulldozers push the top of the mountain off and get at the coal. So we used to have hundreds of thousands of miners in West Virginia. Now a handful of people can handle that industry. So the truth is that if we would move to clean energy, there would be more jobs associated with that and frankly, better jobs. But it does need to be done in a way that develops long-term solutions. We have this off-again, on-again when we subsidize particular choices for new energies, then it kind of comes and goes. You have to keep that subsidy there, and if the subsidy goes away, then the number of jobs decreases. So that's why we need to do it in a way that is simple and honest, and that is to have a rising fee on carbon, and so that we don't then lose the jobs associated with a particular choice. I don't want the government deciding on what the energy choices are going to be. I'd rather have the market make those decisions. But that's why we need to stop subsidizing fossil fuels and stop subsidizing other things also and put a rising price on carbon, and we would then generate a lot of jobs because we would have to move off of fossil fuels on a reasonable time schedule over the next few decades. We can't suddenly move off, but we could over a period of time.
Thanks, Mike. Charlie in Madison, hi.
Hello. I was wondering what might have caused the end of the ice age. What caused global warming at that time?
Yeah, you know, over both very long timescales and over very long timescales like the last millions of years, the principal cause has actually been changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide because the magnitude of the source, which is volcanoes, is variable. The volcanoes occur at the edge of continents as the continents move and subduct beneath them ocean floor and the metamorphosis associated with that high pressure and temperature produces this volcanic emissions of carbon dioxide. And the weathering process takes the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and that depends upon mountain building that providing a fresh rock to be weathered. So over those long time scales, CO2 changed from about 1,000 parts per million down to a few hundred. And so it was the main driver of that very long change. But now, on the shorter time scales, and they're still long by human comparison, but over thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, we go from ice ages to interglacial. And those are spurred by changes in the Earth's orbit. You know, the orbit of the Earth is an ellipse, which the eccentricity of it varies because Jupiter and Saturn tug on the Earth's orbit and they tend to change it. They also change the tilt of the Earth's spin axis, which is now 23.5 degrees, but it wobbles it by a couple of degrees, and when it's tilted more, then you tend to get melting of the ice at the high latitudes. And that, because when you melt ice, it makes the planet darker, so it absorbs more sunlight, and that makes it warmer. And if it gets warmer, the ocean gets warmer and gives up CO2, the same way that your Pepsi does if it gets warm. And so it turns out in that case, these oscillations over tens of thousands of years, CO2 is a feedback. It's not the thing that caused these oscillations, but it does amplify them by changing. The amount that you get out of the ocean amplifies it. And so it's a complicated story, but CO2 is involved in the story.
Thank you, Charlie, for your call. Bill in Lancaster, who I think has some good news to share. Hi, Bill.
Hi, I just wanted to bang a drum of hope. I'm a member of Crop Cooperative, more commonly known as Organic Valley. Our cooperative really pushes both us farmers and the general public to educate themselves on sustainable not only food production but also energy production. Our facilities in Cashton is nearly 100% powered by wind turbines they installed in Cashton. Us farmers are pushed to be educated to produce our own biodiesel for our tractors, put up our own solar panels to power our farms. And they've consistently and constantly pushed us towards sustainable farming and sustainable living, I guess.
Yeah, in the future. And you know what will make it happen?
Okay.
Right?
We had two people talking at once. So, James, do you want to repeat what you just said? Because I didn't hear you.
Yeah, I wanted to say I'm really glad to hear that because that is what we need. And it will happen much more if we put this rising carbon price, because right now we import food from New Zealand and long distances because there's no tax on aviation fuel. In the 1940s, the governments of the world decided they wanted to stimulate this budding aircraft industry, so they gave it this subsidy, and they've never removed the subsidy. But if we have a rising fee on fossil fuels, then these nearby farms will be advantaged, and we will tend to get more of our food from nearby, and especially if those nearby farms are using renewable energy, because this rising carbon fee will not affect those energies that are renewable.
Oh, Bill, I'm sorry we lost you. He was going to talk about, if you want to call back or go to our Facebook page and let us know, I think he was going to let us know about a conference or something that was taking place. So I was going back to you, Bill, but you're not there. Leave us a message if you want to publicize something that talks about what you just, further talks about what you just discussed. Ned in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I support what James Hansen is discussing, and there's a bill in Congress sponsored by Senators Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders called Senate Bill 332. It's the Climate Protection Act, and what it will do is apply a tax or a fee of a certain amount. I think it's $20 per ton of CO2, and it could be improved. What we need to do is dividend back to the people, to all the people in the country, that same tax. And what this does is level the playing field, because the tax is not applied to renewable energy. And the way we're going to do this is by actually providing the free choice that Dr. Hansen has mentioned, a free market approach, and letting people choose to be more energy efficient and buy more energy efficient vehicles and insulation and everything else. The way we could improve the bill is refund all of the money. And right now, they would use 25% of the funds to balance the federal budget deficit. I would rather see all of the funds returned back to the citizens of our country.
Thanks very much. This, I think, is the most important issue. Yes, the Sanders-Boxer bill, they've been listening to us, and now they say they will give 60% of the money back to the public, with 25% used one way and then 15% another way, 25% reducing the country's debt, and 15% used for particular renewable energies. The problem with that is if you only give 60% to the public, then most people will be paying more in their energy price, increased energy prices, than they get in the dividend. That's why I agree with you 100%. All of the money should go to the public. That way, most people will actually get more in the dividend, and they will be in favor of this fee continuing to rise, and that will allow us to phase out fossil fuels over a period of several decades. But if you're only giving them 60%, so most of them are not getting more, then they're not going to be as favorable. So I agree with you absolutely.
And realistically, how much support is there for that? Can you see this Senate bill passing?
You know, when I drive to the airport with a taxi driver and have enough time to explain it, they say that makes sense. But you have to explain it. And that's why President Obama, if he had only used his ability to speak at the time he became president, the first time when he had 70% popularity, he could have explained this to the public and said, well, your cost of gas at the pump may go up, but you'll get this dividend and we can solve our addiction to fossil fuels. But he didn't do that, and it's very difficult for us to communicate with 300 million people. We're making progress, and there's an organization called Citizens Climate Lobby at citizensclimatelobby.org, which is really is now exists in almost all states, and they're trying to get the public to be more aware of this.
James Hansen, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you.
Dr. James Hansen, preeminent climate scientist, he is speaking today at the 10th Annual Sustainability Summit, which is taking place in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in her studios in downtown Milwaukee.